violence prevention programs. We've got 10 seconds.
President Biden is just demonstrating that there's comprehensive solutions to this very complex problem. That includes community, addressing suicide, addressing domestic violence, and just addressing the everyday gun violence that communities of color experience.
I want to thank you, Brian Lemick, Executive Director of Brady Pack. That does it for our show. A happy early birthday to David Prude. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a senior news producer to join our team here in New York City. You can learn more and apply today at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Adriano Contreras, our general managers, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
Supported community radio, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the average daily COVID-19 case rate has nearly doubled in Oregon in the last month. Inverness jail prisoners have sued Multnomah County over exposure to COVID-19, and Multnomah County joins the CDC in declaring racism a public health crisis. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 9th, 2021. I'm Nat Moon. Yesterday, the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners passed a resolution declaring racism a public health crisis. Board Chair Deborah Kafuri said that things like stable housing, employment, education, ease or difficulty of getting health care, and the risk of being a victim of policing practices are all determinants of health. In a statement, Director Ebony Clark of the Multnomah County Health Department said, quote, "White supremacy has shaped our work, our decisions, and our policies, causing ongoing pain, trauma, harm, and negative outcomes for our BIPOC and other communities of color. Why are we doing this work now? Because naming it matters." The Multnomah Commissioner's declaration came the same day that the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention labeled racism as a serious threat to public health. The CDC said it would take a variety of steps to address racism in public health, including the investing of COVID funding in communities of color and other disproportionately affected groups. They also added a new section to their website dedicated to racism and health with the hope of drawing more attention to the issue. In a statement, CDC Director Rochelle Walensky said, quote, "Racism is a serious public health threat that directly affects the well-being of millions of Americans. As a result, it affects the health of our entire nation." The American Medical Association, which declared racism a public health threat in November, praised the CDC's announcement. Yesterday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 678 new COVID-19 cases and 5 new deaths. It was the highest daily count in over 2 months and nearly double the average daily caseload from a month ago. A new model by Oregon Health and Science University has shown that the state could see as many as 1,000 cases a day in early May before dropping mid-month as the number of vaccinated Oregonians continues to rise. To date, over 2 million vaccine doses have been administered in the state. Approximately 32% of Oregonians have received at least their first dose, and 20% are fully vaccinated. OHA officials also reported that of the 700,000 residents who had reached full immunity, 168 have tested positive so far, with 19 requiring hospitalization and only 3 deaths. Many of those who tested positive displayed no symptoms, and the 3 deaths were reported to be individuals with underlying health issues. Dr. Melissa Sutton, OHA's Director for Respiratory Viral Diseases, said that no vaccine is perfect and that the low numbers, quote, shows the vaccines are working really well. Despite the recent uptick in cases, Oregon continues to have one of the lowest caseloads in the country. The state has reported 3,962 cases for every 100,000 residents, making it the 4th lowest rate in the country. On Tuesday, Governor Kate Brown announced that 6 counties, including Clackamas and Multnomah, would be moved back into the high-risk COVID-19 category effective today. But yesterday, representatives of the business community testified in front of the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners, expressing their frustration with Governor Brown's decision to skip the 2-week warning period and order businesses straight back to the high-risk category. And last night, the commissioners signed a letter to the governor asking her to reconsider her decision, saying, quote, "Our residents have been through much, 3 declared disasters in 11 months. While our communities are resilient, many businesses and their employees are on the precipice of collapse." Laura Edmonds, the executive director of the North Clackamas Chamber of Commerce, noted that businesses have been suffering through more than a year's worth of shutdowns. She asked the commissioners to, quote, "ask the governor why we were not actually granted the full 2-week cautionary period, as was promised by her, so that the businesses could ready themselves to reduce and adjust their business offerings and provide more time for their employees to prepare for another layoff." During her testimony, Edmonds said, quote, "Restaurants are a great example. Most had already spent $10,000 to $20,000 for the next week's food. Half of that will go to waste. They're just throwing money away that they don't have." She also pointed out that the rising numbers are primarily connected with schools, but it was the business community that is being restricted. Calling the county's response to the coronavirus, quote, "woefully inadequate," 15 prisoners have filed a class action lawsuit against Multnomah County and Sheriff Mike Reese for negligence. The prisoners contracted COVID-19 while being housed at the Inverness Jail in Northeast Portland. The suit claims that the county and sheriff did not take proper safety precautions and denied testing while mixing infected and healthy prisoners and guards in jail dorms. As a result, nearly 40% of the jail's more than 5,000 inmates had tested positive by February 17th. In late March, Multnomah County Public Health declared that the COVID outbreak at Inverness Jail was over. It was, however, the largest and longest outbreak at either of the county's detention centers. The plaintiffs are seeking a court order that county jails implement social distancing, proper testing, sanitation, and compliance with federal and state health guidelines issued by the CDC and the Oregon Health Authority. The suit is also asking for unspecified compensatory and punitive damages. The sheriff's office has declined to publicly comment on the pending litigation. As part of the $6 million gun violence reduction package, the city has allocated $1.4 million to hiring new Portland park rangers to patrol city parks as goodwill ambassadors. In announcing the increase in park rangers, city commissioners said the rangers would act as eyes on the ground and ensure that, quote, our parks remain welcoming public spaces. But in a story first reported in Willamette Week, Ted Bryan of the Laborers International Union of North America expressed concern for ranger safety. He cited an increasing sense of hostility towards city employees and said, quote, we are worried by the number of assaults, attempted assaults, threats, and harassment toward park staff, including rangers. He asked the city council to provide park rangers with body armor to protect them from projectiles and stab threats. City commissioners are strong proponents of increasing park ranger presence so that parks feel safer for families, but some rangers are concerned that the new program turns them into unarmed park cops. And Brian reminded the commissioners that rangers can only issue citations for people breaking park rules. Brian said, quote, we are not authorized, trained, or equipped to intervene in violent situations, and certainly not in situations involving gun violence. He went on to say that rangers still need police assistance to remove people from the parks. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and advocates are working to raise awareness of online sexual harassment. For more on the story, here's Lily Bolke with the Public News Service.
Nearly one in five women in the U.S. have experienced rape or attempted rape in their lifetime, and advocates want survivors to know resources are available to them. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and Laura Palumbo with the National Sexual Violence Resource Center says this year in particular, they're hoping to raise awareness of online sexual harassment and violence. She notes that with the pandemic, people are not only using online spaces for leisure, but also for work and school.
Online abuse and trauma are somewhat commonplace in online spaces. So people making victim-blaming comments or sexual harassing comments, people preying on children or young adults in online spaces.
Palumbo says it's important for workplaces and schools to create expectations for what safe and healthy conduct looks like online, as well as how to ensure online spaces are secure to prevent things like Zoom bombing or other harmful activities. Lynn Shillette with the New Hampshire Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence says a culture shift is necessary to be more supportive of survivors. She says New Hampshire has made progress in recent years, removing the civil statute of limitations for victims of sexual assault and requiring colleges and universities to implement sexual misconduct policies. But there's still room to grow.
We know that most sexual assault victims don't come forward because they fear being blamed, they fear being shamed. And we as a society have an obligation to create an environment that is more welcoming, that is more in a position to believe victims when they tell us what happened to them.
In Washington, D.C., Congress is in the process of reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act. Shillette says the legislation is crucial for survivors in New Hampshire. Not only does it provide funding streams to Granite State Crisis Centers, but she notes it also ensures a wide array of rights for survivors, from protecting confidentiality at crisis centers to protecting survivors who need immigration relief. For Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke.
Yesterday, a right-wing anti-government demonstrator was arrested twice on trespassing charges at the Idaho Capitol building in Boise. Ammon Bundy was first arrested just after noon and booked into the Ada County Jail by the Idaho State Police at 12:44 p.m. Bundy then posted a $300 bond and returned to the state house where he was again arrested. He was back in jail before 2 p.m. Bundy appears to have a thing for accruing trespassing violations, and these charges are relatively minor for the man who led the occupation and armed standoff at the Oregon Wildlife Refuge in 2016. He was arrested last August when he and more than 100 of his followers shouted down lawmakers considering a bill to shield businesses and government agencies from liability claims related to the coronavirus. With that arrest, he was banned from the building for a year, but was arrested again on trespassing charges the next day. Last month, he was arrested for failing to appear in court because he wouldn't follow rules and wear a mask to enter the Ada County Courthouse. Bundy allegedly then directed his followers to go to the home of the judge presiding over his case to protest following his arrest. Although yesterday's charges are separate, it's possible that his bond will be revoked based on the previous charges. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next at 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Let's Talk About Race. Then at 7, it's Rising Up with Sana Lee. Tonight, we can expect temperatures in the mid-40s with showers rolling in after midnight. Tomorrow, morning showers will give way to a mostly cloudy day with a high in the low 50s. On this day in 1968, murdered civil rights leader and Nobel Peace Prize winner Martin Luther King Jr. was buried next to the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia. Today's quote is from the eulogy for Dr. King, given by Baptist minister and president of Morehouse College, Benjamin Mays. He said, quote, "Too bad, you say, that Martin Luther King Jr. died so young. I feel that way too. But, as I have said many times before, it isn't how long one lives, but how well. It's what one accomplishes for mankind that matters." A forensic pathologist testified today that it was police actions, not drugs, that killed George Floyd in May 2020. The defense team in the murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin will argue that it was drugs in Floyd's system that killed him, not asphyxiation. Multiple medical specialists have now testified that that is simply untrue. For more, we go to Faven Gerezguher with the Racial Reckoning Project.
Thursday, the jury in the Derek Chauvin trial heard expert medical witnesses testify as to how low oxygen levels led to George Floyd's death. Pulmonologist and critical care physician Dr. Martin Tobin presented what he viewed after the first 5 minutes of restraint.
"We're seeing that the level of oxygen has gone down to zero, that there is, at that point, there's not an ounce of oxygen left in his body."
Dr. Tobin explained that the combination of being handcuffed while held chest down on the street and having knees to his neck and back would have seriously inhibited Floyd's lung capacity. He pointed out moments throughout the video showing Floyd's body resisting against these forces to find air.
"So he's using his fingers and his knuckles against the street to try and crank up the right side of his chest. This is his only way to try and get air to get into the right lung."
The defense's stance is that George Floyd died of a drug overdose, not due to asphyxiation caused by Derek Chauvin's knee on his neck. But later witnesses to the stand agreed with Tobin's claim that drug use had no impact on Floyd's oxygen levels. Dr. William Smock, a surgeon and forensic specialist with the Louisville Police Department, added that Floyd's behavior was inconsistent with an overdose or with delirium.
"He's breathing. He's talking. He's not snoring. He is saying, you know, please, please get off of me. I want to breathe. I can't breathe." That is not a fentanyl overdose. That is somebody begging to breathe.
The experts noted that low oxygen levels would not show up in an autopsy. For the Racial Reckoning Project, this is Faven Gerezguher.
President Biden announced an executive order to limit so-called ghost guns, but any meaningful gun legislation requires action by Congress, and gun bills typically die in the U.S. Senate. With more on the story and others, here's Laura Rosborough Tellum with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
They've offered plenty of thoughts and prayers, members of Congress, but they passed not a single new federal law to reduce gun violence. Enough prayers. Time for some action.
President Joe Biden announced executive actions in response to gun violence yesterday, but he said Congress can and should do more than the president alone can. The House has passed two bills to expand background checks on firearm sales. However, Second Amendment arguments in the U.S. Senate have long stalled legislation there. A newly filed House bill, the Handgun Purchaser Licensing Act, would push state and local governments to create permit-to-purchase handgun laws. States like Connecticut now require potential gun buyers to apply for a permit directly from local law enforcement. Jeremy Stein, with a group Connecticut Against Gun Violence, says the 10-year-old state law has curbed gun homicides by 40%, in spite of laxer rules in other states.
About 50% of the guns used in crimes, they're coming from states with weak gun laws, states with no universal background checks, that don't have permit to purchase laws, that allow homemade ghost guns, unregistered, unlicensed, untraceable guns to be sold.
Housing Secretary Marsha L. Fudge announced nearly $5 billion in new rental assistance grants to states and local governments yesterday. The money, part of Biden's COVID relief package, is geared toward affordable housing and other services for people experiencing homelessness. The effort to unionize workers at an Amazon warehouse in Alabama was behind by 2-1 as of yesterday evening. According to the New York Times, almost half the votes had been tallied before counting paused for the night. Meanwhile, a bill to make voting less accessible passed a Texas House committee yesterday. It could jail election administrators who send out absentee ballot applications without a voter request. House Bill 6 is one of dozens Texas lawmakers are considering. The trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer charged with killing George Floyd, is finishing its second week. In December, after Floyd's killing sparked massive protests, the Minneapolis City Council unanimously voted to divert $8 million from the police to fund violence prevention and other services. That's about 4% of the department's budget. But local accountability groups are pressing for other structural changes.
There's not going to be any placating us with half measures or with meaningless promises of name changes and other useless reforms.
Jay Yates is an organizer with the Twin Cities Coalition for Justice for Jamar, founded after two Minneapolis police officers killed Jamar Clark in 2015. Yates says they'll keep demonstrating until a citizen council is in place to oversee the department. Finally, record numbers of asylum seekers turned away from the U.S. are seeking sanctuary in Mexico. More than 9,000 people applied for asylum in Mexico last month. Officials there say that's the highest ever monthly tally. Michaela Savitt, Mike Moan, and Cole Hemstreet contributed reporting. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosborough Tellum. Thanks for listening.
An Alaskan Native community is planning a spring search for missing persons in Fairbanks, and Hopi tribal officials are beginning to lift some COVID-19 restrictions as cases decline. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A community-wide search for missing persons is planned for later this spring in Fairbanks, Alaska. The Alaska Native community is organizing the search. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Frank Manano, Debbie Nicktoon, Doran Sanford, and Willis Durendoff went missing in the Fairbanks area in 2020. Their cases, which are not believed to be related, have been the subject of law enforcement, family, and volunteer efforts to find them. At an outdoor rally for the missing April 2nd, volunteer coordinator Peter Captain Jr. shared preliminary plans.
We have a professional firm that's going to organize the search this spring.
Captain Jr. says the goal is for thousands of people, including hundreds of local military, to search the area in an organized manner, as melting snow and ice may reveal remains of the missing or clues about what happened to them. On another front, Captain Jr. said a reward fund to leverage new information in the cases is also in the works.
We want to raise $25,000
Captain Jr. says the idea is for local Native organizations to match community donations. The fund will be additional to rewards already being offered by families of the missing. And Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Health officials with the Hopi tribe in Arizona say COVID-19 cases have dropped. And as Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, tribal leaders are beginning to lift some restrictions.
Hopi leaders last week approved the first phase of the tribe's reopening plan. They say the 13 villages have met benchmarks established by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and will allow local village administrators to determine which activities to resume and the level of safety measures to keep in place. The tribe's executive order still urges physical distancing, among other safety precautions. Earlier this week, Hopi health officials said they'd confirmed 4 active COVID cases in the past 2 weeks. It's a substantial decline from the reservation's pandemic high in January, when the tribe was managing more than 20 cases at a time and had positivity rates far higher than national and state averages. The flattening of cases is due at least in part to high levels of vaccinations on Hopi. More than half of the reservation's population has received at least one dose, compared to about 33% of Arizona residents statewide. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
Lawyers continue to examine the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals opinion on the Indian Child Welfare Act and its potential impacts. Victoria Wicks reports.
ACLU Stephen Pivar says he is dismayed to find that valuable ICWA protections have been ruled unconstitutional. He notes in particular 2 requirements on state courts or agencies that have been found to invade state sovereignty. One of those requirements is that courts must hear testimony from a qualified expert witness before removing Native children from their homes. Pivar says the expert is ideally a member of the same tribe as the child. He says Congress put that provision in place because before ICWA, children were removed from their homes for situations acceptable under tribal customs.
It's not only normal, but encouraged that children spend weeks, if not months, living with the grandmother or grandfather or an aunt or uncle. And many state court judges and social workers were viewing that as abandoned.
Pivar also notes that the Fifth Circuit found it unconstitutionally burdensome to require state agencies to make active efforts to keep families together before removing children. The appellate ruling does not take effect until June 1st, and it is binding only on courts in Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Pivar says the case is likely to be granted a hearing at the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
At a time when state governments are considering bills that could hamper voting access, West Virginia voting rights groups are pushing U.S. Senators Joe Manchin and Shelley Moore Capito to back the For the People Act to strengthen the nation's voting laws. With more on the story, here's Diane Bernard with the Public News Service.
A coalition of pro-democracy groups in West Virginia is urging U.S. Senators Joe Manchin and Shelley Moore Capito to support the For the People Act, a broad measure in Congress to change voting, ethics, and campaign finance laws. They're also calling on Senator Manchin to reconsider his decision not to oppose filibusters in the Senate, which could block this voting rights legislation. Natalie Tennant served as West Virginia's Secretary of State for 8 years. She points out the act is especially timely as the West Virginia legislature considers a bill that would chip away at voting rights following Georgia's lead.
West Virginians want to be able to cast our ballots freely, safely, and equally. And if state lawmakers, county clerks, and the Secretary of State restrict our rights and our voting rights, West Virginians can turn to the For the People Act.
West Virginia's Senate Bill 565 would eliminate the popular Saturday before the election as an early voting day and require a purge of voter rolls every 2 years instead of 4. Supporters say it would help ensure elections run smoothly. It easily passed in the state Senate and is now in the House Judiciary Committee. The West Virginia bill also would set an earlier deadline to apply for an absentee ballot and end the state's effort to establish automatic voting registration at Motor Vehicle Administration offices. Sam Hickman, who heads the West Virginia chapter of the National Association of Social Workers, thinks the bill would drive down the state's already low voter participation rate.
The results of our election certainly do not point to any fraud or abuse having taken place. West Virginia's legislature is now also doing its best to restrict voter access in the name of preventing fraud and abuse and easing the burden on our county clerks rather than making it easier for voters.
The For the People Act is popular across the country, with 67% of Americans supporting it, according to a national poll, and it has support across party lines, with 56% of Republicans and 77% of Democrats in favor. For West Virginia News Service, I'm Diane Bernard.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 9th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings, Ray Bodwell, Antonia Gonzalez, Laura Rosborough-Tallum, Eric Tegedoff, and Lily Bolke. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mary Sherman, Antonia Gonzalez, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nat Moon. Stay safe, wear a mask.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the idea that you don't shoot the messenger dates back, evidently, to Sophocles. It echoes